From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Post-Katrina New Orleans was more than a disaster area. It was a war zone for some. There were too few police and too many problems, including looters on the streets. So a group of vigilantes in the community of Algiers Point decided to take matters into their own hands quite literally. They picked up arms, blockaded their streets, and used violence against the people they thought were looters. But did they cross the line, taking community security too far? That is the subject of an 18-month investigation by reporter A.C. Thompson from ProPublica, which is an independent nonprofit investigative reporting organization. A.C. recently wrote about his findings in an issue of The Nation magazine, and he joins me now. Welcome, A.C.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's begin with this. Point Algiers is a community inside Greater New Orleans, which largely escaped the devastation of the storm, but ran into a buzzsaw of violence right afterward. What happened?
You know, in Algiers Point, it's separated from the rest of New Orleans by the river. And basically what happened in this community, it's largely a predominantly white area that's surrounded by neighborhoods that are predominantly African-American. And about 15 to 30 folks stayed behind in Algiers Point and basically formed a neighborhood militia. And what I uncovered in my investigation was, while the group said that they were out to stop looters, if you interviewed the people who are on the other side of the guns, what you found out was that African-American males who apparently had committed no crimes were being targeted, attacked, threatened, and shot.
Now, in your article, the white residents say that it wasn't about race, but class. My question is that true, and does it make a difference?
You know, I can't get inside their heads and say what's true and what's not true. I can tell you some of the things that they said. And one vigilante told me the people who were coming into the area were hoodlums from the lower Ninth Ward, and you could look in their eyes and tell they were outlaws. Another vigilante told me, when we heard that people from the other side of the river were coming, we thought we were doomed. So that's the kind of thing that I can tell you. I can also tell you that victims of the shootings say that they were the victims of racial epithets and that the N-word was thrown out at them when they were attacked.
Was there complete lawlessness at the time? And what did the New Orleans Police Department do?
You know, undoubtedly, there was a fair amount of chaos, but I think the sense of the chaos was hyped up by the media and politicians who were talking about atrocities at the Superdome. They were talking about gangs of looters. And really, the situation on the streets was not as dire as the media portrayed it and as politicians portrayed it.
Were you able to determine to what extent, if any, there was looting and to what extent, if any, there was reason, if there was, for these people to be concerned about other folks coming into their neighborhood?
You know, I heard about a handful of crimes in the Algiers Point area. I did not hear about massive looting or criminal activity. But what it seemed like was this handful of crimes became the reason that this group got together, this militia group, and decided to keep everyone out, meaning everyone who is African American. So one man told me, well, I got carjacked. And so the next thing that I did was I got a gun. And when an African American man came down the street in front of my house, I pulled the gun on him and told him, I don't want you in my neighborhood. Now, this white vigilante man had said he'd been carjacked by an African-American. And the next thing that he did was he pulled his gun out on a random African-American man and told him to get out of the neighborhood. Problem was, the guy he was pulling a gun on was his neighbor who lived just down the street from him.
How are things there now and what has changed?
You know, the thing that's interesting to me is in interviews, eyewitnesses, people who were holding the guns, people who were shot, people who were on the scene described 11 different incidents of shooting and attacks to me. And what's interesting to me is that 3 years later, nobody has investigated these crimes. Nobody has gone and asked obvious questions, meaning the authorities, meaning the NOPD, meaning the district attorney's office. And I think that there's a sense from African-American men that I interviewed who were victimized during this time period that no one cares about what happened to them.
Well, right now we're going to expand our discussion about Algiers Point by bringing in the president of the Second Amendment Foundation, Joe Tartaro. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Joe, the aftermath of Katrina brought out a lot of ugliness, as we are hearing, for people who weathered the storm. Do you think that the residents of Algiers Point were justified in their actions?
I think they were justified in protecting their own persons and their property, their families and their homes. But wandering around the streets, as Mr. Thompson reported, sounds to me like they crossed the line.
How do you define the difference between vigilantism and self-defense?
Well, I think vigilantism is an often misused word. It does, and it, by its definition, suggest that it takes place when there is no recourse to existing constituted law. And that certainly seemed to be the case there. There was chaos in the city. There was fear, I'm sure, on everyone's part, whether they were rich or poor, or black or white, or any other color. There was a period in which there wasn't adequate lighting, water, food, and other things. And the city had been ill-prepared to deal with the horrible natural disaster that occurred, and certainly the police, from reports that I recall, and I haven't investigated it recently like Mr. Thompson, but it sounded to me like the entire police force was not on duty throughout the worst part of the storm or immediately afterward.
Let me follow up with you with one more thing, Joe, and that's this. At a time when there is chaos and there appears not to be government control or policing in an area like this, is this the time when having guns is this the best time for citizens to be armed when we're in a situation like that, in your opinion?
I think it makes sense. It's happened before. It happened with Hurricane Andrew in Florida a few years earlier. It happened with the earthquake situation in San Francisco and in Los Angeles and so on. You have a problem where you have a complete breakdown in the rule of law. And I've watched television reports in which police are stopping to talk to victims of some of these other disasters, telling them that if you need anything, tell me now because you won't see us for several days.
Well, AC, what other kinds of vigilantism did there occurred across the New Orleans area, the greater area, in those days immediately after the storm? Or was Algiers Point the only place?
You know, I've heard a lot of stories about the white neighborhoods in Uptown as well, sort of setting up barricades and having people who are armed out looking for suspected thieves and criminals. But really, Algiers Point was the hot spot where you get a lot of reports from people about shootings and about attacks and about threats. And I think that was where most of the serious violence occurred.
In reading your article, one might get the impression that the people who were in New Orleans who had something worth protecting were the white residents and that the black ones were the ones who were trying to take from them. Was it a situation also where there were black residents who were trying to protect their property in the same way that the whites were?
You know, I never interviewed any African-American residents who told me that. I did, you know, occasionally hear from middle-class blacks who'd say, you know, I was glad that the Gretna authorities sealed off the bridge over the Mississippi River and barred folks from the other side of the river from coming over here to the West Bank of the Mississippi, to that part of New Orleans, which I thought was interesting. But I did not hear a lot of stories about this kind of neighborhood watch on steroids and kind of thing going on in the African-American community. It might have, but I didn't hear about it.
Joe, from a Second Amendment standpoint, how can neighborhoods protect themselves without letting things get out of hand?
Well, I think the main thing is people should be prepared in advance. I mean, you have block clubs in many cities. You have neighbors meeting neighbors regardless of color. I've lived in integrated neighborhoods. I live right in the middle of the city of Buffalo, and we have had some problems in various parts of the city. Even in the worst riot days of the 60s and 70s, it never got like this.
AC, you, in your article, you talked about the fact that the New Orleans Police Department has really done nothing with regard to investigating any of these cases, and you've outlined what looked to be incidents of murder, and there's no statute of limitations on murder, of course. Do you think any of these cases will ever be brought to justice?
You know, I think it's certainly possible to. There are people out there who are talking. There is evidence out there that can be gathered. So it's totally possible if the authorities are motivated to go track down folks and do interviews and get evidence. Don L. Harrington is totally willing to talk to anyone who'll listen about what happened when he was shot repeatedly with a shotgun that blew out his jugular vein in his throat.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate your coming in and talking with us, AC. It's a fascinating article, scary also at the same time. AC Thompson is a reporter from nonprofit news organization ProPublica. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. And Joe Totaro is the president of the Second Amendment Foundation, which promotes the constitutional heritage to own firearms. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week, the latest on Zimbabwe's health crisis and political stalemate. Plus, China takes on pirates off the coast of Somalia. And for more now, we've got Emira Wood. She is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Emira, how are you?
I'm well. How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Let's begin with this. In Zimbabwe, where there is mounting international pressure on President Robert Mugabe to step down, South Africa, Britain, France, and the United States are holding Mugabe responsible for the country's economic collapse and blame him for a cholera outbreak that has killed more than 1,000 people. Now, Emira, I'm going to ask you to respond to something, but I want to play a couple of sound bites for you. Here's the first
Sounds
one.
Good.
Over the weekend, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Jindai Frazier met with regional leaders in an attempt to get them to get tough on Mugabe, but Mugabe vowed never to surrender, and he remains defiant.
I will never, never sell my country. I will never, 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 never surrender. Zimbabwe is mine.
Now, Frazier also said that the U.S. is withdrawing its offer to end sanctions and renegotiate with international lending institutions, an offer that had been based on a commitment to power sharing.
We have no confidence that there will be genuine power sharing, which we believe is necessary to put in place the policies that would actually reverse the failed state, the failed economy, and certainly in the political violence, which we're continuing to see today with, you know, more than 30 people who have recently been disappeared over just the last month. Mm-hmm. We can't go on with that.
So, Emira, an awful lot of talking. How long can this stalemate go on?
Well, that's the question. And, you know, it's innocent Zimbabweans, especially the women and children who are suffering from the lack of adequate health care, without food to put on their table. These are the folks that are really paying the price, Tony. It has gone on much too long already. But clearly, since the March election, since the June presidential runoff, it has been month after month of delay. And what is needed is not more saber rattling, really, from Jindai Frazier or other members of the Bush administration or even the European Union. What is needed is the African Union continuing to push, not in its quiet diplomacy, but much more visible in public way, to insist that the power sharing go forward, that Mugabe actually does step down if he cannot agree to the power-sharing arrangement as has been put forward on the table.
But why are the other leaders of the African nations reluctant to stand up to Mugabe more forcefully?
Well, it's exactly this game of rhetoric. So clearly Mugabe, the liberation leader, has a lot of sympathetic ears still because of his historic role in liberation movements, not only in South Africa, but throughout the African continent. What happens when Jindai Frazier and others from the Bush administration speak out, it is almost as if it plays into the hand of Mugabe and his cohorts, essentially saying that they are the only ones that are standing up against the imperialist West. So what is needed is actually African leadership, as has been happening, but it needs to be ramped up to make sure that the deal is not only voiced, but is also finalized, implemented, and put in practice.
So where does all of this, for example, leave Morgan Tsvangirai, who leads the opposition party Movement for Democratic Change?
In a very difficult place. I think the Movement for Democratic Change is in a tough spot now. They have now gone along with this power-sharing agreement, yet they cannot accept the posts in these cabinet positions that are seen as less powerful posts. And so they want not just a name of, you know, co-president, but they want in reality power-sharing. They want in reality the change that the Zimbabwean people so much deserve and need right now. So the Movement for Democratic Change, the trade unionists, the Farmers Association, Women's Associations, human rights activists, all are put in a very tough spot of potentially facing more repression as this stalemate continues.
Well, meanwhile, the cholera outbreak continues, and Mugabe's even saying that it was started by Britain. This is a problem on top of a problem.
Clearly, you have now escalating numbers of people, not only in Zimbabwe, but throughout Southern Africa, exposed, as you know, disease, Tony, you know well, does not know borders. And here you have people going across borders. Lack of access to clean water is the problem. But clearly, infections of cholera can not only create crippling conditions in Zimbabwe, but can easily be transferred to Zimbabwe's neighbors. So this is, you know, on top of a food crisis, on top of an economic collapse, on top of a political crisis, this is yet another and could well be the final straw for Zimbabweans.
We'll stay tuned. Let's move on to the Horn of Africa, where continued piracy in the waters off Somalia have brought international attention to the area. China now set to send warships to take on the pirates and protect their country's vessels and crews from pirate attacks. But aid groups say more needs to be done about the violence inside Somalia. The capital city of Mogadishu has been under siege from an Islamist insurgency. So I guess one question, Amira, is which is worse, you know, the piracy or the poverty?
Well, let's be clear. You know, the core problem in Somalia is a lack of a government. You know, there was a government for a very brief period from June 2006 to December 2006. And the essentially, the Bush administration decided that because that government called itself the Union of Islamic Courts, that they needed to be ousted. They were extremists. And so there began a series of airstrikes back in December 2006, which has further destabilized the situation in Somalia, destabilize the political crisis and also destabilize the economy. There have been food riots in Somalia, as in many other countries around the world. So what you have is, on top of a political crisis and an economic crisis, you now have this issue of piracy. But clearly, there were no pirates in that six-month period when Somalia had a government. And what is needed now is not for China, nor the U.S., nor the European Union, nor any other country to go forward with either naval assaults or potentially now under a new UN resolution, you know, going on the land to pursue these terrorists. So airstrikes could potentially happen in Somalia now. What is needed is not this further militarization of the Somali situation, but essentially going at the root cause here, working with Somalis to really be able to put in place, to help Somalis put in place a government that they see as credible, not as occupiers or proxies for external forces, whether the U.S. or the Ethiopia, but a government that Somalis believe represents their interests, can help put together not only a political resolution, but an economic resolution that meets the needs of the people.
I don't know if China or any other nation is really listening to that point of view, Amira, to be quite honest with you. And in fact, the piracy has not only, it has spread south from the Gulf of Aden, going down towards Kenya on the eastern coast of the Indian Ocean. That seems to be a widening problem, doesn't it?
But Tony, once you have a government that can assert its sovereignty, control its territorial borders, that is the opportunity to actually address these issues. And we have to remember there are also international measures. You have, you know, international policing, Interpol, and other mechanisms through which there can be greater policing. This piracy is an issue of organized crime, right? So we have to deal with it as an issue of organized crime and not insist that the solution is to bring in whether Chinese or American or other navies and armies and militaries to further destabilize the Somali crisis.
Well, there certainly is a great deal of news coming out of Africa, keeping you very busy. We appreciate your taking the time to share your information and knowledge with our audience, as you always do so very well.
It's an honor. Thank you, Tony.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now to a largely untold chapter of African history when Nubian kings conquered ancient Egypt. The so-called Black Pharaohs ruled for nearly a half century. They played a major role in unifying the country and created glorious monuments which still stand today. Their story appears in this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. Robert Draper is the author of the article, and he joins me now. Robert, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Your most recent book, let's talk about this first, because it's curious to me, is about George W. Bush. So how did you become involved in research about Black Pharaohs?
Well, it is an interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? But in fact, one of the Black Pharaohs, arguably the mightiest of them, Taharqa, has a certain amount in common with our president in that they both have had a healthy estimation of their abilities, perhaps were possessed by hubris, no shortage of self-confidence in any event. But I do dare say that I'm probably the only individual who has gone from interviewing a sitting president in the Oval Office to 72 hours later standing on the banks of the Nile and admiring the pyramid in which Taharqa is encased.
It was a fascinating article, and the pictures were just as fascinating. One of the pharaohs that you feature is, I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly, P.A.
Correct.
Talk and P.A.'s rule over Egypt. Talk about the significance of that particular pharaoh.
Well, P.A. was significant because he did indeed conquer Egypt, perhaps at the behest, it's still rather unclear, of elements within Egypt who believed that that Egypt had been floundering for the previous three centuries, had lost a lot of its spiritual and cultural traditions of the New Kingdom era and was riven by tribal warfare and corruption and economic decline. And so PA, in the meantime, as a southern neighbor to Egypt and what we now know as Sudan, was preserving a lot of these pharaonic traditions and perhaps, though we're not certain, at the invitation of Karnak priests. He believed that the way to save Egypt, in essence, was to invade it. And invade it he did, overthrowing the warlords, but though there was a certain amount of bloodshed, showing no particular interest as a conqueror. Instead, made a kind of truce with the warlords, returned some of the governance to them, and then retreated back to present-day Sudan. But that essentially inaugurated what we now know as the 25th dynasty of Egyptian rule, which was a roughly 90-year period from 770 BC to about 656 BC, during which Egypt was ruled by what we now know as Sudan.
One of the interesting things about the article is the fact that this information has not been passed along from generation to generation. I want to read a passage from the book to you and ask you to talk about it. It makes reference to the fact that there were more pyramids in Sudan than in Egypt. And here's what it says. The first time, and we're talking now about Charles Bonnet, an archaeologist, a Swiss archaeologist, who wrote in 1964, who said in 1964 these words. The first time I came to Sudan, recalls Swiss archaeologist Charles Bonnet, people said, you're mad. There's no history there. It's all in Egypt. And it seems that at some point, attitudes perhaps changed, but maybe not enough as they should have. What did change in terms of the recognition and the acknowledgement of these and this, of the study of these Black pharaohs?
Sure. Well, to back into that, the acceleration of European colonialism of Africa in the 19th century led to the discovery of these great Nubian pyramids that you're referring to, but the prevailing mindset of the times was such that these great structures, it was believed, could only have been built by Egyptians or other Caucasians. And it's almost embarrassing. It is rather embarrassing, frankly, to read the turn-of-the-century texts in which these Nubian contributions were scoffed at as the work of primitives, or explained away by saying, well, they must have been led by Caucasians, by Egyptians or something. This only began to change around the time of the man you referred to, Bonnet, in the early 1960s. And Bonnet and the American Timothy Kendall and others like them, they were schooled in a more enlightened atmosphere of the civil rights era, and they began to travel to present-day Sudan with a less jaundiced eye. And what they began to discover was, in fact, that this was a sophisticated culture that not only was, in fact, run from sort of deep in Africa, but indeed was in a lot of ways autonomous from Egypt, with its own construction and burial customs. So this wasn't just the work of a bunch of cunning mimics, but for a very, very remarkable civilization in its own right.
Here's my next question. How much of this evidence, the writings, pyramids, other ancient civilization structures, let's put it that way, how much of that remains today?
Well, a fair amount, but not as much as one would like. Of course, this is, you know, the corollary, I suppose, to the victor goes the spoils, that to the subjugated go ruins. And the Nubians, since they were in power for only about a century and were much despised by the Assyrians and others, had many of their likenesses defaced and, in fact, obliterated. For example, the Pia, whom you mentioned, the great pharaonic ruler of the Black Pharaoh. We don't even know what he looks like. We only know that his skin color was black. And so, to some degree, we are reliant on the conquerors of the Nubians to describe Nubian contributions, which, of course, is a very, very tenuous way to view Nubian history.
Would that explain why some of the pharaohs, the images of the pharaohs in the article, they look as much Eurocentric as Afrocentric?
Well, to some degree, yeah. There's again a lot of sort of flip flopping that you see among archaeologists and among these renderings, and there's a lot of blurred lines too. You know, there's a line that I mentioned in the story that's drawn a fair amount of interest, and in, that says that the ancient world was devoid of racism, which is not to suggest that there wasn't subjugation or enslavement or discrimination on the basis of class or culture, but pigment itself was not the marker in the ancient world that it would later become, and African women who were married by Egyptian royalty didn't just become concubines; they were oftentimes queens, and we see likenesses of these queens. The children of these of conquered Nubians were often schooled by the finest Egyptian tutors, and so there are all these blurred distinctions. You see in Egypt dark-skinned warriors and light-skinned warriors side by side, and it's very telling, I think, that race isn't so much of a marker, but viewed through 19th and 20th century eyes, I think that became a point of confusion.
Your suggestion, and we have about 30 seconds, your suggestion in the article was that the emphasis on skin color actually came out of Europe later.
That's
on.
Yes, that's exactly right, and archaeologists in later years would be very much influenced by the thinking of that time, but that was not the way it was back then. Egyptians looked down on Nubians, but they looked down on everybody. They looked down on Libyans and Asians. They believed themselves to be superior, but that was much more of a civilization thing than a skin color thing.
Robert Draper, thank you so much. Robert Draper is a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. He wrote this month's cover story, Black Pharaohs. You can see pictures of the Nubian kings at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Robert, once again, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Here's a listener favorite from 2008. Now to a largely untold chapter of African history when Nubian kings conquered ancient Egypt. The so-called Black Pharaohs ruled for nearly half a century. They played a major role in unifying the country and created glorious monuments which still stand today. Their story appeared in National Geographic magazine, and I spoke with Robert Draper, who wrote the article. Your most recent book, let's talk about this first, because it's curious to me, is about George W. Bush. So how did you become involved in research about black pharaohs?
Well, it is an interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? But in fact, one of the black pharaohs, arguably the mightiest of them, Taharqa, has a certain amount in common with our president in that they both have had a healthy estimation of their abilities, perhaps were possessed by hubris, no shortage of self-confidence in any event. But I do dare say that I'm probably the only individual who has gone from interviewing a sitting president in the Oval Office to 72 hours later standing on the banks of the Nile and admiring the pyramid in which Taharqa is encased.
It was a fascinating article, and the pictures were just as fascinating. One of the pharaohs that you feature is, I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly, P.A.
Correct.
And P.A.'s rule over Egypt. Talk about the significance of that particular pharaoh.
Well, P.A. was significant because he did indeed conquer Egypt, perhaps at the behest, it's still rather unclear, of elements within Egypt who believed that that Egypt had been floundering for the previous three centuries, had lost a lot of its spiritual and cultural traditions of the New Kingdom era and was riven by tribal warfare and corruption and economic decline. And so P.A., in the meantime, as a southern neighbor to Egypt in what we now know as Sudan, was preserving a lot of these pharaonic traditions and perhaps, though we're not certain, at the invitation of Karnak priests. He believed that the way to save Egypt, in essence, was to invade it. And invade it he did, overthrowing the warlords, but though there was a certain amount of bloodshed, showing no particular interest as a conqueror. Instead, made a kind of truce with the warlords, returned some of the governance to them, and then retreated back to present-day Sudan. But that essentially inaugurated what we now know as the 25th dynasty of Egyptian rule, which was a roughly 90-year period from 770 BC to about 656 BC, during which Egypt was ruled by what we now know as Sudan.
One of the interesting things about the article is the fact that this information has not been passed along from generation to generation. I want to read a passage from the book to you and ask you to talk about it. It makes reference to the fact that there were more pyramids in Sudan than in Egypt. And here's what it says. The first time, and we're talking now about Charles Bonnet, an archaeologist, a Swiss archaeologist, who wrote in 1964, who said in 1964 these words, "The first time I came to Sudan," recalls Swiss archaeologist Charles Bonnet, "people said, you're mad. There's no history there. It's all in Egypt." And it seems that at some point, attitudes perhaps changed, but maybe not enough as they should have. What did change in terms of the recognition and the acknowledgement of these and this, of the study of these black pharaohs?
Sure. Well, to back into that, the acceleration of European colonialism of Africa in the 19th century led to the discovery of these great Nubian pyramids that you're referring to, but the prevailing mindset of the times was such that these great structures, it was believed, could only have been built by Egyptians or other Caucasians. And it's almost embarrassing. It is rather embarrassing, frankly, to read the turn-of-the-century texts in which these Nubian contributions were scoffed at as the work of primitives or explained away by saying, well, they must have been led by Caucasians, by Egyptians or something. This only began to change around the time of the man you referred to, Bonnet, in the early 1960s. And Bonnet and the American Timothy Kendall and others like them, they were schooled in a more enlightened atmosphere of the civil rights era, and they began to travel to present-day Sudan with a less jaundiced eye. And what they began to discover was, in fact, that this was a sophisticated culture that not only was, in fact, run from sort of deep in Africa, but indeed was in a lot of ways autonomous from Egypt with its own construction and burial customs. So this wasn't just the work of a bunch of cunning mimics, but for a very, very remarkable civilization in its own right.
Here's my next question. How much of this evidence, the writings, pyramids, other ancient civilization structures, let's put it that way, how much of that remains today?
Well, a fair amount, but not as much as one would like. Of course, this is, you know, the corollary, I suppose, to the victor goes the spoils, that to the subjugated go ruins. And the Nubians, since they were in power for only about a century and were much despised by the Assyrians and others, had many of their likenesses defaced and, in fact, obliterated. For example, the Pia, whom you mentioned, the great pharaonic ruler of the black pharaoh, we don't even know what he looks like. We only know that his skin color was black, and so to some degree we are reliant on the conquerors of the Nubians to describe Nubian contributions, which of course is a very, very tenuous way to view Nubian history.
Would that explain why some of the pharaohs, the images of the pharaohs in the article, they look as much Eurocentric as Afrocentric?
Well, to some degree, yeah. There's again a lot of sort of flip flopping that you see among archaeologists and among these renderings, and there's a lot of blurred lines too. You know, there's a line that I mentioned in the story that's drawn a fair amount of interest, and that says that the ancient world was devoid of racism, which is not to suggest that there wasn't subjugation or enslavement or discrimination on the basis of class or culture, but pigment itself was not the marker in the ancient world that it would later become, and African women who were married by Egyptian royalty didn't just become concubines; they were oftentimes queens, and we see likenesses of these queens. The children of these of conquered Nubians were often schooled by the finest Egyptian tutors. And so there are all these blurred distinctions. You see in Egypt dark-skinned warriors and light-skinned warriors side by side. And it's very telling, I think, that, again, that race isn't so much of a marker. But viewed through 19th and 20th century eyes, I think that became a point of confusion.
Your suggestion, and we have about 30 seconds, your suggestion in the article was that the emphasis on skin color actually came out of Europe later.
That's
on.
Yes, that's exactly right, and archaeologist in later years would be very much influenced by the thinking of that time, but that was not the way it was back then. Egyptians looked down on Nubians, but they looked down on everybody. They looked down on Libyans and Asians. They believed themselves to be superior, but that was much more of a civilization thing than a skin color thing.
That was Robert Draper, a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. He wrote the story, Black Pharaohs. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. During this time of year, you can expect to see images of Santa Claus everywhere. Rosy red cheeks, a big pot belly, long white beard. For the most part, we all know what Santa looks like, right? Wrong. In recent years, efforts to diversify Santa's image are gaining ground, and it's not so unusual now to find an African-American, Hispanic, or Asian Santa at your local mall. Joining me is Joe Kahn, a staff writer for the Boston Globe. He wrote an article about Santa's ethnic evolution called Change You Can Believe In. Hi, Joe.
Hi, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. I suppose this is one of those things that people think about but don't always talk about. When did this trend towards diversifying Santa Claus get started?
Well, I think it from what I know, it accelerated in the 1990s, but it's probably going to gain more steam now for a reason we can talk about in a minute. But going back to the historical roots of Santa Claus, it really goes back to, I guess, the area that is now Turkey and a saint named Saint Nicholas who did not look a lot like our current image of Santa Claus, which really came about in the late 19th century and was sort of cemented in popular culture by first the poem that we all sort of know as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, The Visit of Saint Nick, and by the illustrator Thomas Nast, who illustrated it, and then particularly kind of after World War I by things like Coca-Cola and its advertising and the emergence of the department store mall Santa now
Let me stop you there, only because when I was a youngster, Santa Clauses were all white. But by the time my kids came along, Santa Clauses started to get darker and darker and darker, right?
Yeah, hallelujah, I think we can fairly say. Although I must say, when I started casting about here a little bit, in New England, there are not very many Santas of color, certainly not in the department stores and malls where the so-called professional Santas work. And by and large, they are the, you know, full natural bearded Santas who really look like Santa's supposed to look, as opposed to just the guys with the polyester beards. Down south, you do find them more, certainly in metropolitan areas like Atlanta and in the D.C. area, where the African-American population
is larger, obviously. Yeah. Let me play something for you and the audience. This is Bo Stubblefield Tave. He is a Santa Claus portrayer in Boston, and he talked to us about his observations as an African-American Santa. This is his second year as a Santa Claus, and he said that having African-American Santas is especially important for young black boys.
So many of the images we see of black men are more like 50 Cent or whatever, and I think it's very positive for them to see positive black men. Obviously, we have a president here in Massachusetts, we have a black governor, and Deval Patrick, but I think other positive images are very helpful. Santa's certainly one of those.
So how do parents explain the different color Santas that their kids are coming across in the malls and shopping places around America?
Well, I'm not sure there's a how, but I think that is a key part of this. When I talked to some families who had come to the holiday party that Bo was at as Santa, overwhelmingly they said, you know, for their young kids, they were just beginning to get some awareness of race and skin color. And for many of these parents, they had at home black Santas or holiday ornaments and decorations that reflected their own ethnicity. And they were beginning to get questions maybe from 4- and 5-year-olds about, you know, Mommy, how come our Santas at home are black, but the ones at the mall are white? You know, as kids get older, they make their own evaluations and adjustments to what they see in the culture. But I think what was true for earlier generations of Americans, just accepting that Santa looked a certain way, whether it was on a holiday card or in a shopping mall, that's changing, and that should change. And that conversation about race and skin color, particularly at this time of the year, I mean, this is a magical time of year when we're really celebrating everything that we share and have in common. And a couple of the parents commented to me that they basically told their kids, look, Santa Claus is magical, and he can be whatever color you want him to be or whatever house he's in, wherever he is. And I think that kind of consciousness is tremendously appropriate for this season.
Well, you know, let me just say to you that I understand there's a mall not very far from our NPR offices here in Los Angeles where they have a black Santa, a white Santa, a Latino Santa, and an Asian Santa, and you can have your picture taken with either of those ethnic Santas by appointment. You heard of anything like that?
I certainly have heard that down south. There are some big malls in the Atlanta area where they do have that, and they do let families know about a choice. And part of the big business of Santa now, Santas are really run by some large photo agencies. The business is really having your children's picture taken at the mall with Santa. And that becomes, you know, a lasting keepsake of the holiday season. And why not have a keepsake that you really admire and want to preserve? And then your kids look back and go, oh, yeah.
That was Santa Claus. Joe,
listen. Santa looked like me.
Thank you very much for taking the time with us. Have a happy holiday and ho, ho, ho to you.
Back at you. Thank you.
That was Joe Kahn. He is a staff writer for the Boston Globe.
Fonfon season,
Develop an original voice, and eventually you'll be heard and validated. It's what many aspiring artists say to themselves when honing their craft. For African guitarist Lionel Leweke, the day to be validated came in 2001 when he auditioned for the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz. His judges, jazz greats Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter. That's enough to make any musician trip over his own confidence. But Leweke seized the moment. Flash forward to the present, and he's one of the most in-demand jazz guitarists in the world. In fact, one command performance came from our very own Farai Chidea, who's always looking for a way to be serenaded.
So the story that folks tell about you goes like this. You were one of many musicians from around the world auditioning for the Thelonious Monk Institute. And so the panel of judges included superstars Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, and Terrence Blanchard, some of the biggest names in jazz. And when they saw you play, they all looked at each other and said, "We found an original." What's your story from that day?
Well, I was nervous for sure that day. And I knew that before I get in the room, I thought to myself, I just want to be myself. You know, I don't want to sound like anybody else. Just play through from my heart and see if they like it or not. And at the end of the audition, you know, they were clapping, they were happy, and I was happy too.
What did you play?
They asked me to play Footprints by Wayne Shorter.
Do you think you could play just a tiny, like a minute of Footprints for us now?
Oh, I can try.
Okay.
Okay.
That is great. Now, what about the clicking and the vocalizations you do? How did you start it, and do you have a name for it?
No, I have no name for it. Actually, I started doing this like not too long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. It came out to me. I was playing a gig and I was playing an intro, and I don't know how where it came from. So, and now you know, it is part of me, and it's getting better. I'm getting better at it. You know, only the instrument is not enough at this point for me. I need them out as well.
So, you're from Benin originally,
yes.
A New Yorker at this point in your life.
Yeah.
What do those flavors bring to who you are as a musician and what you play?
Well, you know, a lot of stuff, a lot of music I grew up with, I learned still with me. I remember some of them. And even today when I write music, I think I write music with having those elements, you know, somewhere in my head. So they're always there somehow. I can't really separate, you know, the life I had before and the life I'm having now. They all, you know, it's one unit.
Do you come from a family that played music?
My grandfather was a singer, a traditional singer at the village.
So when you decided to leave the country and pursue a much more structured musical career, did anyone say, "Hey, Lionel, that's kind of crazy. What are you doing?"
Oh, yes. Started from my father. You know, it's part of everyday's life. You know, you hear music everywhere. You hear musicians pretty much everywhere in Africa. So why make a career out of that, you know. And my thing was, you know, I wanted to study music, not just play like I used to play, you know, on the street. I wanted to study, go to music school, you know, get better, especially jazz was my thing. I wanted to study jazz. So
you ended up studying in Ghana, in Paris, at the Berklee School of Music in Massachusetts, all an amazing journey in and of itself. But I wonder if you can take us back once again to a time when you were first either learning to play or first performing, and play something for us that takes you back in time and tell us when, you know, what part of your life it's from.
Well, I'm going to play a song by Francis Bebe. He's a great composer, singer from Cameroon. I don't speak the language, so I remember transcribing by ears whatever he was singing. So let me play this for you.
Odimbe olowo somangata sangalanga motalanga mamoe. Odimbe olowo somangata lakalanga monsangalanga tamoe. Oi bina na singatinga tumambo. Oi bina na sanika mikumambo. Oi bina na singa kimakumago. Oi bina na stami kamikumango. Sana yo city, sana yo city, oh. Jesua bamu. Sana yo city, sana yo city, sana yo city, oh. Jesua bamu. Hey, blem leo, o ya u blem leo. Hey, blem leo, o kosa blem leo. Sana yo city, sana yo city. Sana yo city, oh, sana yo city.
Something like that.
That was great.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your bad self. So let me ask you about your own band, Gelfema. You put this group together. You have people who come from different parts of the world. How do you feel that multiculturalism plays into the team that you've put together to work with and also into music, particularly jazz? I mean, what is it about cross-cultural influences that reshapes music? Do you even think about it in that sense?
Yeah, well, the group is called Gelfema, and it's based on the trio. Frank Nemeth is the drummer from Hungary, and Massimo Biolcati, he's half Italian, half Swedish, is the bass player. The way I see jazz anyway, you know, even if people say jazz is, you know, from Africa or from America, it means to me that it's a mix of culture. In Benin, we have our own culture, but our culture just didn't appear for no reason. It came from somewhere. So, and that place is everywhere. So I believe on a mix of culture, and I think it goes for anything, politically or anything.
Well, I love the picture of the three of you, your core group, standing on the Brooklyn Bridge.
That's right.
Great place to be.
That's right.
Well, I'm wondering if you can play us something from your new album, Gelfema Plus Two.
Okay. I'm going to play actually the first track on the CD. It's called Twins. And I'm going to try to play it by myself. All right.
That was NPR's Farai Chidea talking with jazz guitarist Lionel Luecki. You can hear Lionel with his group Gelfema on their latest CD, Gelfema Plus Two. That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, from Broadway to battling breast cancer, actress Diane Carroll has been an inspiration for decades. We will continue our Living Legends series with the boundary-breaking African-American actress. I'm Tony Cox. This is News and Notes.